This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There is going to come a point when this shutdown really starts to bite. Not individuals, that's already happening. I'm talking big picture here. And the question is, when? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Friday, the 18th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Day 28, I think, is the number. The president and the speaker are trading pokes in the eye. 800,000 people are still in some weird kind of limbo. And the American economy? Well, that's why we're here. Neela Richardson's at Edward Jones. Dion Rabones at Axios. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai. Good to be here.
So, Neela, let me climb in with you first here, and I don't want to get to the shutdown yet. Let's save that for the end. I want to point out that for all the chaos and economic noise that's out there, right, China and Brexit and the shutdown and all of this, corporations are doing pretty well. Earnings are all right, and stock traders seem to be happy.
That's right. We saw a lot of volatility at the end of last year. You might have seen your retirement statement and was a little shocked.
Don't look every day.
Because the good news is we saw a sharp rebound and the overall underlying fundamentals, both on the economy side and the corporate side, look pretty stable, look pretty good going into this year. But we think there's a slowdown ahead. And you know why, Kai? It's that fiscal stimulus will be missing. There will be no U.S. tax cuts driving 20% plus year-over-year earnings growth. It'll be a more modest number. And so we have to get ready for more modest expectations for the stock market.
Wow. I did not plan on taking a downer of a turn here, Dion, quite as quickly.
But yeah, me neither.
Yeah, right? Is what Neela is saying is there's nothing to look forward to economically?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't like to talk like that. Neela does. But look, I mean, the corporation should be excited. They saved, I think it's more than $100 billion last year thanks to the tax cuts. Most of that tax cut revenue went to them. They really didn't hire a lot more people. What they did was buy back shares of their stock. So that should have sent and did send stocks moving higher. We also might see a little bit less of that this year. So that could be unhealthy for the stock market. Also, as I point out, it's really getting to be a great time for savers. So if you are someone who's risk averse, you're right now getting really good rates on CD certificates of deposit. Actually, you're getting, I put out an article a little while ago, more getting paid more on a 12-month CD than you are on a 10-year treasury note.
Wow. Now, would you say you're getting really good or you're getting better than it's been in a long time? I don't want to get down.
Better than it's been in a long time. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And still good for stocks, just not the 20% plus earnings numbers that we saw last year.
Okay. So now let us take that turn, shall we, to the shutdown and Neela to the question I posed in the open. 28 days, a lunar month, if you will. When does the economy start to feel the pain that people have been feeling for a while now?
So the expectation is for every 10 days that the government stays closed, a tenth of a percentage point gets shaved off of GDP in the first quarter. So we are going to see some economic hit to this in the first quarter. It'll be short-lived, but the shutdown casts a long shadow, right? Because it builds this uncertainty that weighs on consumer and business sentiment. And that does have some impact past the first quarter, in addition to the personal costs we're starting to see mount up the longer the shutdown it goes on.
Sorry, to be clear, you're saying that pain will last even after everybody gets back to work, assuming that happens sometime reasonably soon.
When you look to D.C., you look to a body of decision makers. And we're getting to a point where the cost of staying closed is actually going to be even with the cost of what's in dispute, which is the $5.7 billion for the border wall. So that uncertainty does have an effect on the economy. It does have an effect in terms of consumer sentiment, consumer optimism. We got some numbers out like on that this morning, and people were pointing to the shutdown as weighing on their sentiment for the year.
Right, exactly. All right, so Dion, so talk to me now about bigger picture. And you know, I've mentioned this with other folks on a Friday. about the real moments of stress in the economy. There will be another crisis at some point. And the question is, if we can't now decide on how to make the government function, and I'm not doing a both sides thing here at all, but we simply cannot open the government, what happens when the economic poop hits the fan, if you will? Right?
That's an explosion. That's things. Yeah, this has been a real worry for some time, and not just here in the U.S., but as we talked about, I think, last time I was on the show, you're just seeing kind of a rollback of democracy functioning the way it should, which is people of different sides or who have different beliefs come together and they compromise and they find something in the middle. And we're just entering this space where everyone only wants exactly what they want and they don't want to agree. And the shutdown, now the longest in the U.S. history, is really an example of that. The president demands his wall. The Democrats refuse to give him the wall. And they both just kind of say, well, then I'm taking my ball and going home. Hmm. And who's really hurt is all of us who need the government to function. And eventually, as Neela pointed out, this is going to come back and start biting us. You're already seeing, I actually saw one economist say that if this shutdown does last through the first quarter, he's expecting us to actually post negative growth for the first quarter.
That would get people's attention. Neela, speaking about measuring the economy, as the actual trained economist on this panel here, Neela, in 30 seconds, how big a problem is it for you that we're not getting some government data, right? I mean, parts of the government are open and giving us like jobs reports, but you know, the Commerce Department's closed and they do all kinds of economic reports.
So we started this conversation talking about how volatile last year was because people were uncertain about the direction of the economy.
Right.
Well, that uncertainty is still in the markets. That volatility hasn't gone away. And what people rely on, what traders rely on and economists rely on to give us a sense of direction is data. And so missing data will only breed more uncertainty in the market, more volatility. So data is a crucial part of how we make decisions. And so the longer the shutdown goes, we're basically tying one hand behind our back.
So to add a little sunshine to this discussion.
Usually an optimist.
Yeah, well, let's start an up note, but let's do it fast. Go.
The stock market is having its best government shutdown ever. So there is that.
Oh, yay. Deandra Bowen at Axios and Neela Richardson. She's at Edward Jones. Thanks, you
well
two.
Said. Thank you.
Thanks, Kyle.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, if you were looking, as Deon sort of alluded to, if you were looking for your Santa Claus rally before Christmas, you should have waited just a day. All three major indices just wrapped up their fourth consecutive up week since the Christmas Eve bottom. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A curious thing happened on the way to our all-electric vehicle future today. Tesla announced it's going to cut 7% of its workforce, something near 3,100 people. That is actually not the interesting part. The company did a 9% cut back in June. But in a letter to his employees, CEO Elon Musk said he had to make those layoffs so that he could lower prices, which is great. Cheap Tesla Model 3s for all my friends, right? Except that in that same letter, Musk also said Tesla has to crank out cars faster, which he is going to do with fewer workers. How? Marketplace's Mario Segura has that one.
Tesla wants to get more people driving its electric cars, but its cheapest car, the Model 3, starts at $44,000. Jessica Caldwell at Edmond says that's about $7,000 more than the industry average for a new car.
So I think if they truly want to grow their market, they're going to have to produce a vehicle that is something that more people can afford.
So Tesla is trying to lower its prices by cutting production costs, workers' salaries. Thing is, the company is already having trouble getting cars out the door. Matthew Carolian lives in Boston and ordered a Tesla Model 3 in March 2016. That's, hold on, let him do the math.
1,023 days.
He was excited about the car. Still is.
I'm like a real car nerd. So that was the big hope with the Tesla, that it would be like really great sports car performance that doesn't, you know, ruin the future of the planet for my children.
For now, he's driving a Prius, which he got when the wait for the Model 3 got too long. Other customers have given up and canceled their orders. So Tesla needs to push out cars faster while also cutting its workforce.
And that's inherently hard to do. You know, you're basically doing kind of a contradictory thing.
Carl Brower at Auto Trader says there are a couple ways Tesla could go about this.
You could have more automation in certain parts or stages of the production.
Or find other ways to be more efficient, which he says gets easier the longer Tesla is around. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
AT&T has apparently decided YouTube might not be so bad after all. A couple of years ago, the telecommunications giant, also, by the way, one of this country's biggest advertisers, was among a bunch of companies that pulled their ads off YouTube because those ads were running alongside videos with controversial content, hate speech and terrorism-related stuff, that kind of thing. AT&T now says it is satisfied the Google-owned platform has changed its ways. Marketplace's Erica Barris explains how YouTube has changed and whether other advertisers are likely to follow.
AT&T pulled its ads from YouTube to avoid the risk of their running on ISIS recruitment videos, for example. Michael Smith, who teaches information technology and marketing at Carnegie Mellon University, says it was important for the company to pull its ads.
Not just for moral reasons, but I think also for branding reasons, to say we want no part of hate speech or other discriminatory voices.
Other marketers followed AT&T away from YouTube. Now the telecom company says it's going back because the platform has improved its artificial intelligence so that there is a near zero possibility that its ads could end up next to offensive content. But Catherine Trendacosta, an analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is skeptical.
The only way they could be successfully doing this is if they've removed anything even remotely resembling speech from YouTube.
AT&T says it's satisfied with test results on the platform. Another reason an advertiser would want to come back to YouTube? That's around 1 billion visitors a day, says Ming Xu with UC Berkeley's Business School. And if AT&T goes back to YouTube,
I think a lot of companies are looking for a leader to kind of follow. That if AT&T kind of goes ahead, then it will be a sign that, well, something has been done.
AT&T isn't the first to put its ads back on YouTube. In April of last year, Procter & Gamble, the largest advertiser in the U.S., returned to the platform. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We're going to do a quick immigration tutorial. Now, not the contentious southern border immigration that's the root cause of the shutdown. It's more of a visa regulations tutorial, really. You've probably heard of H-1B visas, right? The ones a lot of tech firms use to hire highly skilled workers, many of them, as it happens, from India. Lesser known but still vital to the economy are H-2 visas, which come in two flavors. H-2A visas for temporary seasonal agricultural workers, and H-2Bs, also temporary and seasonable, but not farm-related. They work in tourist hotels and ski resorts. Also, they do landscaping. Anyway, Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta told the Wall Street Journal yesterday that the system for those visas, H-2Bs, is broken and needs fixing. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the business case.
For about 20 years, the Mount Rushmore Resort and Lodge in South Dakota used H-2B visa employees from places like South America for cleaning and maintenance jobs.
H-2Bs we stopped using 2 years ago because of the cap.
That's the Lodge's general manager, Nathan Lael. That cap is 66,000 H-2B visas in a fiscal year. Competition for these low-skilled workers is so fierce that
securing an H-2B employee became quite difficult.
He says there are not enough South Dakotans to fill the jobs, which only pay about $9 an hour. Now he has to bring in international students over the summer to do the work. But despite some businesses turning away from H-2Bs, demand for the visas has been growing dramatically.
I got twice as many inquiries this year as last year about the H-2B program, so clearly there's a need. I know unemployment's really low.
Peter Kramer is an immigration attorney. He says you have to start applying for these visas 6 months in advance, prove that you've tried to hire U.S. workers, and beat other employers to the punch. Kramer says he was one of the more than 100,000 applicants trying to submit at midnight on New Year's.
But the system crashed this year. So we spent 45 minutes or more trying to get in, and then they closed it down for a week.
Perhaps the biggest problem with H-2B visas, according to immigration attorney Rosa Malia Acevedo, is that there aren't enough of them.
I think the cap is unrealistic.
She says last year the Labor Department made an exception and gave out a few thousand more H-2Bs, but she can't guarantee to her clients they're going to do that again.
So I have to go with what the reality is. And if the number gets depleted before we're able to apply for their actual visas, then that's it.
The U.S. Department of Labor didn't reply to a request for comment before deadline. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They've talked about the idea of a $1 trillion cost to the global economy of this.
Global shipping could be getting a whole lot more expensive. But first, let's do the numbers. Not a bad close to the week, really. Dow Industrials added 1.3%, picked up 336 points, did the blue chips, closed at 24,706. The NASDAQ was up 1%, 72 points, 71.57. The S&P 500 gained about 1.3%, 34 points, 26.70. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained almost 3%, the NASDAQ up 2.6%, S&P 500 gained 2.8%. Had that Tesla layoff news go over? Not really so well. Shares plunged almost 13%. Sorry to laugh. Other automakers were humming right along, though. Ford edged up 2.6%. General Motors climbed 0.9%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.78%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. And look, I want you to subscribe to Make Me Smart. It's a podcast all about tech and the economy and culture. And this week, it's all about Instagram. Molly and I might spend less time on Facebook these days, but it's harder to stay away from its cooler and younger platform. So is Instagram any different than its parent company, Facebook?
I mean, I think you're kidding yourself if you think it's not all sucking your data.
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Shutdown or no, the Federal Reserve is still open for business, the Fed funds itself, in case you're curious. And in about 10 days or so, the 29th and 30th to be precise, the Federal Open Market Committee is going to meet to take stock of the economy and have what I promise you will be a much dissected conversation about interest rates. Dr. Lael Brainard is going to be sitting around that big table in the conference room at the Fed's building in Washington, being, as she is, a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. Dr. Brainard, good to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
On the theory that it is, as we've been reporting and as y'all at the Fed have been saying, on the theory that it is healthy, how healthy is the American economy right now?
Well, generally speaking, the labor market is extremely healthy. We've got the lowest unemployment rate we've seen in almost 50 years. And wages, finally, after a long period of not moving, are now up at 3%. So the labor market looks good, and the U.S. consumer has been pretty resilient. But there are some risks out there.
Yeah, so let's get there, right? Because while the economy may be strong, there is no small amount of I'm going to go to the politics first. There's no small amount of political tourists out there right now. You got the shutdown. You've got globally Brexit. You've got discontent in Washington. Where does that fall on your scale of things to worry about?
The shutdown, let's start with that. Yeah. There's just uncertainty about how long that's going to continue. People are wondering what's going to happen with trade in China.
Yeah.
And then, you know, further afield, as you said, Britain and the votes that they're having in Parliament about their relationship to the EU, all of those things are risks that if they were to materialize would be negative for the economy. Well, we're not seeing as much risks out there that would be a positive surprise.
Positive risks, yeah. But look, the point is that those risks are materializing, right? The government is shut down. China is slowing. Brexit, I mean, who knows? Where, as people listen to this interview, they're going to be looking and listening for signs that perhaps there is more trouble to come.
So I think certainly for my own part, as I look at that set of risks, there are things that could get resolved in a very positive way. But of course, as you say, you know, the longer these drag on, the more I worry that they really materially weigh on consumer confidence, business confidence, and then start to work their way through actual activity in the economy.
You'll notice that I haven't asked you about interest rates or the dot plot or any of that good stuff that comes up every time you all have a meeting, which is coming up in another, 10 days or so. And I haven't because that gets plenty of coverage. But the question I want to ask you about that is too much attention paid to every muttering of yourself and your colleagues on the board and your statements?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, it's important for us you know, on the Monetary Policy Making Committee to try to communicate in a way that the public understands how new developments in the data will affect how the outlook is likely to evolve. So, you know, rather than reacting to every new sentence over time, if we're doing our job well, I think we would hope the public would understand that we are actually achieving what Congress asked us to do, which is to be at full employment and to get inflation at a stable 2% level.
Do you suppose you don't get enough credit for actually doing what Congress told you to do?
Well, it's a hard job. And, you know, every American household is connected to the financial system. And that's a very big responsibility. So, no, I expect to be held accountable. And I expect to have a really good debate about how we exercise the policy tools Congress has given us.
Dr. Brainard, thanks very much for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
As Dr. Brainard and I were just talking about, you take a look around the global economy, there are all kinds of downside risks. The trade war, Brexit, those are the biggies. What about marine fuel costs? Marine as in boats. Those prices could shoot up next year after a ruling by the United Nations agency that regulates shipping. It's called the International Maritime Organization. It wants to clean up the global shipping industry. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London, where the IMO is based, businesses are watching oh so closely.
Generating up to 40,000 kilowatts, this ship's engine is one of the most powerful machines on the planet. But it's also one of the most polluting, using, as it does, one of the world's filthiest fuels.
Marine fuel is residual fuel that's the bit that's left at the bottom of the refinery.
It's a waste product, says Richard Mead, editor of the Lloyd's List shipping journal. And when ships burn it, they pump sulfur into the atmosphere.
The sulfur content itself is deemed to be quite harmful, been proved to be behind respiratory diseases in coastal areas.
Midships!
Here's the problem in action.
Port 10.
A captain manoeuvres a giant car ferry into its berth.
Midships!
15% of a ship's fuel is burned getting in and out of port. More is burned in coastal waters where the wind can carry the ship's exhaust inland. This kills up to 100,000 people a year, according to a study in Finland. Edmund Hughes of the International Maritime Organization says this was something the shipping industry could no longer ignore.
There was a clear demand for shipping to reduce its emissions and control its emissions further and bring down the level of sulfur in the fuel.
The result? An IMO regulation forcing ship owners to switch to low-sulfur marine diesel from January the 1st next year. A social imperative, he says.
Society is increasingly demanding that the fuels that we use have a less of an impact on wider society.
But there's a hitch. The switchover imposes huge costs on the refining industry as it scrambles to produce enough extra cleaner fuel. Jack Jordan is with the energy analyst S&P Global Platts.
To get more diesel out of your crude, you need to be installing all sorts of upgrading units in the refineries. These things can cost billions of dollars per refinery.
Which could discourage some refineries from upgrading, leading to shortages. The price of marine diesel could soar by 30% or more. The cost would surely be passed on to ship owners, and since they transport 90% of the world's traded goods, it'd be passed on to consumers. The total cost, says Jordan, could be huge.
They've talked about the idea of a $1 trillion cost to the global economy of this.
$1 trillion?
Absolutely astronomical cost.
Not everyone subscribes to this nightmare scenario. Edmund Hughes of the IMO believes that the refining industry will be ready to supply the new fuel.
We are confident that there will be fuel available, certainly in the key fuel supply hubs, and there will be the compliant fuel available.
And Bob Sanguinetti, head of the UK Chamber of Shipping, representing Britain's commercial fleet of 900 vessels, is also not unduly worried.
I would say the cost implications are unclear.
there will be, no doubt, some pain, but I don't think it'll be quite as seismic as some people out there have us believe.
Nevertheless, the impact of the IMO regulation could reverberate around the world. 80,000 vessels will need the new fuel. If the price does soar, the repercussions for the global shipping industry could be enormous. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, once again, context is everything. The Washington Post reports today that the Federal Trade Commission is considering, and this is a quote from the Post, a record-setting fine against Facebook for its data privacy, shall we say, shortcomings. Here's what you need to know to put that in the right perspective, though. The previous record-setting data privacy fine by the Federal Trade Commission was $22.5 million against Google. Facebook's net income for its most recent quarter, because I know you want to know this, was $5.1 billion with a B, American dollars. All right, we are out of here. Dow Industrials added 1.3% today, 336 points. The NASDAQ up 1%, pretty much even, 72 points. The S&P 500, 1.3% higher, 34 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.